Everybody, welcome to our workshop with Sharon and Celine this morning. We're going to be talking about rejection-sensitive dysphoria. And I'm just going to give a moment for people to come in. We've got lots of people here, and we've got lots of members because we've just had Friendship Week and lots of members coming in. So, welcome to everyone who's new. If this is your first masterclass in the Idea Lab, I just want to tell you that Sharon is one of our go-to experts. She's like our utility player. She can present on anything, it seems, and her research is always solid, and her approach really works for our community. Sharon's a clinical psychologist based near Boston, really knows our population personally and professionally. So, Sharon, welcome to Bright and Quirky. Welcome back.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you for that beautiful introduction. And I'm wearing a turtleneck today and a jacket because it snowed here last night and this morning. I'm like, whoa, it's April showers bring May flowers, not April snow showers.
Oh my goodness. All right, well, bundle up.
So it's so good to be here on this kind of really gloomy day. This is a bright spot for sure.
Well, we're
Thanks.
glad you're here, and parents, we're so glad you're here. If questions bubble up, go ahead and put them in the chat, and Casey will save them for the end, and we'll see if we can get to a few of them. Now, I really wanted to talk about rejection-sensitive dysphoria coming off of Friendship Week because it really is the worst thing to be rejected by another person. It feels terrible. But a few years ago, in the field, I started hearing this acronym for rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And so, Sharon, let's just start with what is it? Is it a formal diagnosis? If we were to go see our child's doctor, would they know about it? And how does it differ from everyday rejection?
This is a really great question. That's a great series of questions, and I could talk about this topic for a very long time. What I want to say is, I'd like us to zoom out for a minute as a group and think about the umbrella of social anxiety. Or so we have social anxiety at the top. Then underneath, we have rejection sensitive dysphoria. And then underneath that, we have perfectionism and imposter syndrome. And so these four conditions are all related, but the diagnostic category is social anxiety. There is no diagnosis of perfectionism or imposter syndrome or RSD for that matter. And it's important to understand that because we know that rejection, that social anxiety is a debilitating fear of judgment by others in social situations where a person may be exposed to humiliation or rejection. And it's fundamentally attached to a core belief of deficiency, true for RSD, true for perfectionism, true for imposter syndrome. It can last for at least 6 months and it will restrict activities, interests, and relationships. The National Institute of Mental Health has found that about, well, 12% of all adults experience social anxiety, and it's really one of the most common anxiety diagnoses. Let's sort of rewind a little bit. So what we see, that's 12% in the general population, but in the population of neurodivergence, the research, particularly on ADHD, shows a third of kids with ADHD have an anxiety disorder. A third of kids with an anxiety disorder, that can also often be social anxiety. That occurs about a third of the time for kids with ADHD. So we can have general anxiety, we could have social anxiety, we might have other forms of anxiety. So the anxiety and neurodivergence, particularly ADHD, cohabitate often. It's even higher in adults for those of you who might have anxiety. It's about 50% of those for adults with ADHD. So one of the things that we want to think about with social anxiety before we even get to RSD is that You can be an extrovert and have social anxiety. I'm an extrovert. Sometimes I have social anxiety. But also, that social anxiety is a process where you think you know what the other person is thinking about you, and you become very concerned about this projection onto the other person when you actually really don't know what the other person is thinking about you. But that really is part of social anxiety. Uncertainty about how an event unfolds is really at the core of all types of anxiety. Social anxiety used to be considered a phobia. It was called social phobia, like a fear of spiders or elevators. But powers that be made a change and decided that because of these underlying core beliefs of deficiency that get activated in social situations or through a rejection or something like that, it needed to be its own diagnostic category. Hope I'm not
Okay.
boring you too much with
No,
all
but
of
I have
that
a couple.
background, but I need to set the scene at the restaurant before I can talk about the main course here.
No, exactly. That's so great. And a couple questions for you, Sharon. You know, we talk a lot about the iceberg model and how you see certain things, certain behaviors on the surface, but to really affect change, we need to look at the root cause. And you mentioned the core belief of deficiency. And I think, you know, if we're talking about a peanut allergy where we see a swollen child, you know, we can treat the swelling, but what's really going to help is if this child doesn't eat peanuts to begin with because they have an allergy. So similarly, if we think about this core belief of deficiency at the root, how did it get there and how do we treat that?
Yes, so that's an excellent question. What's interesting, if we think about it, is that we have to go back to childhood, you know, and of course we're parents here. I'm a parent of two children. My youngest is neurodivergent. Didn't find that out till later. Super embarrassing on my part. What we find is that there's this process when you're neurodivergent of what I call the thousand paper cuts of trauma. So this is the little stuff every day that accumulates. Oh, you know, you overshared. Oh, you spoke too loud. Oh, you were too aggressive in the kicker game. You forgot to turn in your homework. You accidentally pushed your sister, whatever it is, all of these things that happen where neurodivergent kids are in their minds messing up when they didn't even know that they had made a mistake in the first place. Okay. And so this experience that they have is that I'm not okay. I'm not okay. I'm not okay a lot of the time. And a vigilance develops and really becomes like a hypervigilance. And that's that deficiency underneath. I'm not really okay just as I am because I keep messing up. And then on top of that is that worry. When is the next time I'm going to mess up that I didn't even know I was doing something that was questionable? So these two things combine, and when we put them in social situations, what we see is a sense of I'm not good enough the way I am, and other people know that, and they're judging me, and they can see the ways that I'm not good enough. It's like they can see inside of me. And even adults do this.
Yeah. Well, what's so interesting to me, Sharon, we're like totally geeking out in our zone here, aren't we? What's interesting to me is like if we reframe this as these thousand paper cuts, not that it's a cognitive distortion. It's not like you're not thinking correctly about it, but it doesn't mean you're deficient. It means that the fit either with society or the other people is off in some way, that round peg in the square hole. And then we need to correct for that either by environment or building skills, but there's this core belief that it's based on reality that we have felt this rejection. We might be predicting into the future rejection that hasn't happened yet or interpreting a future situation that way. But I love that you're talking about the origin of it because the paper cuts are real. We have to validate the paper cuts are real.
Yes, I'm just turning my light on because I look a little dark in the gloom and in the gloom of my day here. The paper cuts are real, and actually, one of the many reasons that I love collaborating with you and being invited to come to your groups, Debbie, is because we can geek out a little bit. I feel like in the world today, people want quick solutions. They want strategies to fix things that are not quickly fixable. But we can rewrite personal narratives. It takes time. We can learn how to build confidence. It takes time. None of these things are going to happen overnight because the core belief that I'm deficient didn't happen overnight. It wasn't like you woke up one day and there it is. It was these little paper cuts that eventually you woke up and you're like, wow, I have a big cut on my arm that needs a bigger band. Needs a bigger bandage than the little band-aid I'm using. So I think that's part of the issue.
Yeah, and I think what helps us so much, which is like half the solution, is defining the true issue, which is the core belief. So now we can work on reframing that core belief and skills to connect with other people.
Right. And this is where, this is the beauty of internal family systems, which I know you talk about. Because there are parts of ourselves. So I identify with my clients, even my young ones, who is that inner ogre or inner bully, and what kinds of things are they saying to you that are critical and put you down and make you feel terrible about yourself? And then we have an inner ally. And with some of the kids I work with, I call it the inner Jedi Knight. And I love that. Because I think about, we're carrying our lightsaber, and anytime we can just put it out there. The inner ally wants to fight the inner ogre, but it doesn't work. Because if we fight the thing that is judging and criticizing us, and we tell it, it gets bigger, it's stronger than the ally because of the negativity bias in our brains, right?
Yeah.
Because our brains, our bodies, we humans are geared toward holding on to what isn't working more than what is.
Yeah.
And
And I
that
think this, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, and that goes into relationships, which is where we get into RSD.
Okay. Now, as a parent, my natural inclination would be, and I think this is for many parents to say, oh, honey, people do like you. And oh, honey, it wasn't that bad. And you have a good relationship with Johnny and Sam, and explain it away, sort of. But I'd like to get your opinion on this. I love this idea that we could introduce to our kids that we have different parts of ourselves. Like, I think a kid could relate to, I want to do well in school, but I really don't feel like doing my homework. Those are two different parts of myself within myself. Likewise, I'll just finish the thought. Likewise, there is a part of me that is very judgmental of me, that I am somehow not acceptable, that, I'm getting rejected because I'm deficient in some way. And then there's another part that I could strengthen. That's my Jedi Knight that could say, hey, buddy, we just either need to like find your people in the things that you enjoy, or school's not a safe place. We're going to find a new school, target, some new friends we could make friends with. Like, this is totally doable. I get that it's hard, and I want to learn more about it, how it's hard, and there's hope. So just validating the different parts of self.
So reassurance doesn't work with anxiety. It doesn't work really with any form of anxiety, because, and it's what parents we do naturally. Because when our kids are young, when they're toddlers, of course we reassure them that we've got, we, you know, that things are, you know, we are this place of safety. And we still are that for kids who, you know, are in kindergarten and beyond. But those kids are spending more time in their days away from us. And so what we want to teach them is to how to talk back to themselves, to talk back to that ogre, to reassure the ogre that you've got it. And it you can see that the ogre is worried or afraid or doesn't want to do this homework because it's so hard. And that there are times when you've done something hard and you can do it, right? What happens for a lot of parents of anxious kids is we reassure our kids in the following ways. One, don't worry, it'll be okay. Two, that's not such a big deal. And three, you know, I'm here for you, and I'll take care of it. So the thing is, you're not always going to be there. You don't know things are going to be okay, and it can feel like a very big deal. So, you know, minimizing or dismissing and reassurance don't work because they don't teach the self-soothing skills that kids need. And this is especially true in social situations. You're not there. And so your child has to learn how to reassure themselves, how to prop themselves up, how to know that they have their lightsaber in their back pocket, right?
So if you were the parent, Sharon,
Which
of
I
a
am,
child,
Karen. Yes.
which you are, let's say your child is 10 years old, had a rejection event at school. What are the words you would use if we're going to give parents like a
Anybody,
little script?
of course you're upset. Anybody would be upset in this situation. It's hurtful and it's mean. And I love you and I'm here for you. And let me give you a big hug. We can
Oh, they should.
brainstorm. We can brainstorm what to do about this a little bit later when it's not so fresh. Right now, I just want to let you know anyone would be hurt in this situation. Of course, you're sad. So
Okay,
we're
and then when we're out of the heat of the moment, what's part two of the
that would be let's sit down and think about what your inner ally, and I ask my client, and I think you ask your kids to name your inner ally and name the inner ogre. So, for example, maybe your inner ally is Sydney Superwoman, okay, for example. What would Sydney Superwoman want to do in this situation? What would she want to say? How could Sydney Superwoman help you feel more confident? Okay. The other thing that I find very helpful is I practice with kids. Well, what's the worst thing that could happen? And then what? So we could do a couple of those to see, you know, their imagining of where the worst case scenario goes. And then I flip it and I ask them, what could go right? What might you enjoy? What's an escape plan if you need one? Right? Because kids need strategies.
beautiful.
I do want to say a little bit about RSD since that's why I'm here and you asked me. So, you know, RSD for neurodivergent kids are wired to feel things more intensely. And what happens is that RSD refers to the intense feelings related to the belief that you've let someone down, that you've embarrassed yourself or failed at something or made a serious unfixable mistake. And as a result, people will pull back their support, their love, or respect. RSD causes extreme emotional pain that can plague both neurodivergent children and adults, even when no actual rejection has taken place. So it's the perception of the rejection versus a real rejection, and both can hurt equally. It's not just like, wow, that feels bad. It's like a physical punch in the gut. It's a physical punch in the gut. So what we see is that people with RSD struggle with letting go of past hurts. They may hold on to unkind words or actions directed at them for months or years. It's hard to shake off comments, and at some level, you believe these negative comments that you're hearing because of that core deficiency. So it's hard for you to bounce back. You're coming from a one down, two down, three down position. And this really fosters and feeds the shame and the shame spiral.
Wow. Good stuff. Good stuff, Sharon. Can you discern for us a little bit? I would think rejection is hard for everybody. And then just like everybody feels anxious at times, but then we meet clinical criteria for an anxiety disorder when it starts getting in the way of daily living. Where is that line between rejection's hard for everybody and this is RSD that needs treatment?
Well, that's a very good question. So Dr. William Dodson, who is, an international expert on ADHD, found that he was seeing these patterns of extraordinarily painful reactions to rejection in his clients, and he will in his patients, and he will say that experiencing RSD is one of the hardest aspects of living with ADHD. I think, we see the difference between having rejection be painful, typical rejection, neurotypical rejection, or average rejection, and versus signs of rejection sensitivity, dysphoria, struggle, persistent struggle with low self-esteem. Easily embarrassed or ashamed, quick to anger in response to a perceived rejection, very high expectations of others and how they should treat you. You experience social anxiety. You may engage in self-harming behaviors. We see this with more with middle school and high school kids with ADHD who have intense RSD. They're in a lot of pain, and so they might engage in cutting or other types of self-harming behaviors to relieve the pain of the feelings. We'll see this sometimes with bulimia also, that there's an overwhelm of feelings. And these are people who anticipate, not just anticipate, expect rejection in new situations. It's not like, oh, I think it might happen. It's like, yes, I'm just waiting for the rejection to occur.
And that's sort of a coping strategy that the brain takes on to protect us, correct?
Right. And that's why cognitive behavior therapy is so important for treating social anxiety and rejection sensitive dysphoria, because cognitive behavior therapy with or without medication, and the medications would usually be something like some that treats anxiety, maybe Buspar, or it might be an SSRI. Those can help. ADHD medications can help as well. But just like with ADHD, pills don't teach skills. So you can take medicine to help, sort of thicken your skin a little bit. And this is the experience of a lot of people who take SSRIs, is they feel like there's a little bit of distance between the experience that they have and their feelings around it, which before they were really merged. So we want to create healthier alternatives to safety-seeking behaviors, to be able to be present instead of lost in those thoughts that you have, either about what other people are thinking about you, or your thoughts related to the fear of when is the rejection going to occur. And in order to do this, we have to set very low risk experiments to build confidence. So these are learning experiences that might test or even defy those negative self-beliefs. So I'm going to say hi to one person when I walk into the classroom today and see how that is. I'm not going to necessarily go, up to somebody on the playground and ask if I can play with them. I'm not there yet. I'm just going to say hi to two people in school. I'm going to tell you who those two people are, and I'm going to do that for a week or a day. And then what's the next level? And then so you come up with these sort of tiered experiments, which is very much in sync with how cognitive behavior therapy works.
We would call these exposures.
Yes. So you have smaller exposures that are not as important, so to speak, or as heavily weighted, so that then you can build up confidence in your skill. So, for example, if you have a child and you go to your local cafe to get a hot chocolate, and your child doesn't want to order the hot chocolate themselves, they want you to do it. Or your child frequently wants you to speak for them instead of them speaking for themselves. You might say, okay, well, let's, and they want to wait in the car also. So you might say, you know what? Here's the first level of the experiment. You're going to come into the cafe with me. You don't have to say anything, but you're with me when I order. And then you take the hot chocolate yourself. Level one, right? Level two, you're going to come in to the cafe. We're going to stand in line. I'm going to order the hot chocolate, and you're going to, and when they say with whipped cream or without, you say with. We're going to do that. So you just see, these are very small things. And as parents, you could literally be tearing your hair out because they take so much time to learn. But it's important that we go slowly so that they're comfortable. Because if they feel the least bit comfortable, they're going to slap failure on it and walk away.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think explaining this to a child that, hey, there's something that feels scary. And we're going to break it down into the tiniest steps that feel doable. And then you're collaborating together and you're giving them a framework for a way to handle something that's scary. And I think parents, it's very helpful to know that when your child is stuck, think about we in here in the Idea Lab, we talk a lot about 1% gains. What is
Yes.
the 1% thing that is so small they could do that they couldn't fail? Like, I love your idea of just say hello to one person in the classroom, or there's probably an equivalent at recess, just make eye contact and smile at someone as maybe a first exposure. So I really love that we're tying RSD into like a bigger framework of anxiety because the same skills are transferable.
Right. That's why it lives under the umbrella of social anxiety, because that's we're working with both of them. And what part of the thing that helps with addressing rejection sensitive dysphoria is consistently nurturing strengths and focusing on what kids love to do and do well. This is where we build confidence. It's like I mean, I know I'm using the Star Wars metaphor, so please, if it's too much, let me know. But Yoda talks about, like, don't be do, or don't do just be, or something, whatever, I forget. But it's a combination of being and doing. That's the point, right? Because we want to teach our kids that actually the force is with them, that they're that ally is with you at all times. It may be very small or shut off, or you don't know how to get to it. One of my clients, who is a teenager who's been struggling a bunch in high school and has social anxiety, post being rejected by a couple friends, we were talking about this inner the inner ogre, and I said, well, how big do you think it is? And they said, Well, it's like an inflatable Tyrannosaurus Rex that goes from here to the sun. I said, that's pretty big. And I said, well, how big is your inner ally? And they said, well, she's solid, but she only goes to my knee. So, okay, now we have something to work with.
Gotta love that.
And I ask kids to name them. So I'll tell you, my inner ogre is Perfect Poindexter. Like, I really like to get things right, and I have very high standards for myself. It is kind of not th these this is the, when I'm in that place, I am not in my best self. My best self is Tina Trailblazer. Tina loves to go hiking. She's really fun and funny and outgoing. She sings and does musical cabarets that she creates. I mean, she's a whole force, literally. And so we as parents, we want to nurture your kids' Tina Trailblazers. You know, name them. One of my I one this this I did this colleague of mine said, so she was working with a second grader, and they were trying to name that inner ogre, and the second grader said Mr. Bossy Pants, and that it was Mr. Bossy Pants. And I love that. We were laughing in our group, and then I said, well, what's the name of the ally? And the therapist said, we haven't gotten there yet. That's next week.
Wow. Sharon, I love these examples. I absolutely love them. Is there sort of an exercise, a little homework you could give parents right here? How would they name their inner ally and inner ogre? And then take that experience and help their child name theirs.
We could do that right now, shall we?
Woo, I love it. Let's do it.
Okay. I'd like you to take a minute. So wherever you are, and close your eyes and roll your shoulders back, put down your pen, and I'd like you to breathe in for four, hold for four, and exhale for six. And I'll walk you through this. So breathe in, two, three, four, hold, two, three, four, exhale, six, five, four, three, two, one. And this time, when you do it, we're going to do several rounds of this. I'd like you to breathe in a very soothing color down through your nose, through the trunk of your body, down your legs, down your arms, into your hands. So breathe in, two, three, four, hold, two, three, four, exhale, six, five, four, three, two, one. Now do a round on your own. In for four, hold for four, and exhale for six, and pause. And each time you take a breath, you feel the warmth of that light coming in and really relaxing you into your breathing and this moment. Imagine that you're walking by the ocean. It's a warm day, not hot. The sky is clear with a few clouds. There are some birds. You're walking along the ocean and you're thinking about something that is bothering you, something that you are criticizing yourself for. Does that part of you look like? Maybe sit down on the beach. What does that part of you look like? The part of you who tells you you don't get it right, you're not okay, other people are smarter, other people are more accomplished, you're not enough. What name would you give that part of yourself? Maybe there's a person in your life who might have told you things like this, and that name could be attached to that person. So I want you to take a deep breath in, and we're going to hold that person on one side. Maybe put it on your right shoulder. That character. And exhale This time, when you breathe in, I want you to breathe in a different color. Hold for four, exhale for six, and pause. Now, I'd like you to think about someone who really loves you. Maybe it's a grandmother, maybe it's a puppy, maybe it's your partner or your child or your mother. Or father, someone in your life who really loves you, who's on your side. They may be with you, they may not in your life today. But breathe in for four, seeing their face. Hold for four. Exhale for six. Now ask them, what is it they really love about you? What are some of your unique strengths and talents? What name would they give that part of yourself? And put that on your left shoulder. Take a deep breath in for four, hold for four, exhale for six, and pause. Listen to the ocean. To the squawking of the seagulls, smell the salt water, feel the breeze, and know that you are both of these things. One is not better than the other. Well, actually, that's not true. We would like the ally to be bigger than the ogre, but we need both for balance. Slowly, take your final round of what I call triangle breathing. Breathe in for four, hold for four, exhale for six. And when you're ready, open your eyes and arrive back in the room. And if you're inspired and comfortable, which I hope you will be, write down the name of your ogre and your ally. When we name them, when we claim them in a safe group like this, we own parts of ourselves that might have been disowned, that we don't like, that we push away. Our ogres developed to protect us. Our allies are here to help us connect with our true selves, the part of you that is loving, wise, warm and caring.
Oh, Sharon, beautiful.
So take a minute and, if you want to, I don't know how you do this, Debbie, so I'll let you facilitate, put it in the chat, turn your mic on and share, but, maybe whatever you'd like, but it is important to claim that. I'm curious, Debbie, did anything come up for you?
Okay, got to unmute here. That was deep. That was deep. I mean, what's fascinating is I could pinpoint both people who those voices were coming from. On the ogre side, a perfectionistic parent. So I was thinking, like, messing up Melissa, like, come on, you're messing up. You're not doing enough. You should have it done already. I remember hearing as a child, you only get one chance to make a first impression. There aren't any second chances, old stuff like that. Then on the other hand, I have a friend who's just always propping me up and, just reminding me of my best self, and I don't have a name yet, but I just have so much love for this friend, and we've been friends for over 15 years, so I just love having her in my life. We have a parent saying, "Loving Laura Lou and Polly Pain in the Butt," based on
I love
Grandma's.
that. Polly pain in the butt. I might have to add that. Perfect Poindexter pain in the butt. I think I might have to borrow that. That's so great.
Let's see. People think this is really powerful. My ogre was a former boss. And let's see. Yes, and we will have a recording. Oops, that chat thing just fell out of the chat. And then my ally were two people, my mother and a friend who's far physically, but always like a sister to me for decades. That's so lovely. Karen, I know we need to wrap up, but we had a few questions come up. Are you open
Of
for a
course.
couple
Well,
of questions?
I gave a lot of information, and I just put into the chat a downloadable that you can get through my website. Also, I have several blogs on my website about RSD and social anxiety, so I would encourage you to check those out.
And your website is
Oh yeah,
sharonsaline.com.
I'll put that right here.
Okay, great.
All right, let's ask the questions. I'm all yours.
Okay, all right, let's see. Casey, move your handy dandy Google Doc here. When you say self-harming behaviors, what type of behavior should I be looking out for as a parent?
Cutting, food restriction, isolation, over involvement with technology. I hesitate to use the word addiction, but just like valuing technology as life rather than as a portion of life. It's a piece of the pie, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. It's not the whole pie. That's
Okay.
the things I was thinking of.
Great. Suggestions on how to tease out the hurts or rejections from a teen who is no longer sharing all of these experiences. And I'll add to that, kids who just aren't natural talkers and aren't very forthcoming to ask.
So what I think helps with teens who are more reticent is to be able to use observation. So I'm noticing that you are spending more time in your room alone. I'm noticing that I haven't seen or so and so come over, doing an activity with them. So teenagers will not have like a regular straight up conversation with you them a lot of, with you a lot of times because of their privacy needs and boundary needs, which can be sometimes extreme. So if you're like making brownies or going shopping or doing something that is that they like to do or that's an activity that you're both engaged in, that's a good time to have a conversation. Sometimes in the car, things like that.
Another little tip that I have found helpful with teens and just kids who don't talk a lot about this is I would go home and share this experience that I just had. Like, I learned about this thing. I did this exercise. I have an inner ally and an inner ogre. In fact, we all do. And here's what my two are. Being the nerdy therapist mom that I am, I'd then say, oh, do you want to do this little exercise that I learned? Or we could watch the video together. Or just to say, what would you name your ally and your ogre? And they can share or not share, but by modeling that vulnerability, that's a tool that can open a door. Do you find the same?
Yes, I do. And I think that's very helpful.
Okay, great. How do we find a therapist who knows how to do these exposures and the reframing of the core belief of deficiency, all of that good stuff?
That is an excellent question to which I do not have an excellent answer, unfortunately, because I think that it's hard to find therapists like this. You can find therapists who have training in internal family systems, but they might not know a lot about neurodivergence. And you can find therapists who are, trained in ADHD or understand the effects of ADHD on child development, but they might not have training in this this particular approach. So I think what we want to do is to find someone who can offer you a variety of tools that you can then practice. And so we want to ask people, what kind of experiences do you have with this? Have you studied this? Who have you worked with?
And
You are
CBT for sure, right?
CBT
Cognitive
for sure.
behavioral
Thank you.
therapy.
I, yes, thank you. I
And maybe even trauma-informed CBT.
absolutely. Trauma-informed CBT would be great. Because what happens is you'll take your a lot of people take their children to see someone who for individual therapy, for ch individual child therapy, and that is not actually the most helpful thing for neurodivergent kids. Really, we want what is kind of what Debbie does with you, which is parent behavior training. And then if kids have the ability to, often by the age of 10, those neurodivergent kids, because some of them are mature more slowly, then they might benefit from some individual therapy, individual play therapy. Certainly tweens and teens will want to talk to someone who's not you, so that can be very useful as well. But if your child does see an individual therapist, you want to make sure that there are what's called collateral sessions where you're the collateral. So, for me, when I work with kids, I only will see them every other week alone. And then I absolutely do family work the other 2 weeks because kids don't grow up in a petri dish.
Exactly. And we want the parents to have these skills.
Yes.
Sharon, I know you have another commitment. We do have a few more questions.
That's okay. I can stay a little bit longer. Go ahead.
Okay, great. There's a question about for teens struggling with incapacitating anxiety. Do you know any inpatient treatment that's neurodivergent friendly? I have not found that over the years. If you have a golden name, that'd be amazing. You just went on mute. I'm not sure why.
That's weird. Okay, I can't say that I know that. I mean, I live in Massachusetts, so I know that there are programs around here that not necessarily are neurodivergent in, sort of at the core, but people are very well informed, like at McLean Hospital, for example, or other places like that in Boston. I think the thing is for you to ask. And for particularly to put your teen in a program where there are other kids like them is very important. Otherwise, they won't get any benefit out of it.
Yeah, so Google, you can Google programs in your area that have the trauma-informed CBT. After the step of identifying the inner ogre and the inner ally, what would be the very next step to use this insight? And I'm just going to say how I use insights like this is I try to catch myself in the moment thinking like the ogre and then saying, let me invite the inner ally to the party, what would she say? Is that
Yeah,
a next step for you?
I think when I'm, when perfect Poindexter pain in my butt, thank you so much, whoever said that. I'm gonna make it PPP, triple P B or something like that. When that voice is there, I identify that voice. I'm like, okay, pointy Poindexter, Dex, what's going on? What are you afraid of? What's making you uneasy? And then I'll try to deal with that. But I'm a full grown adult. I'm not a 10-year-old. And so what we can do with our kids is say, that sounds like, awful ogre is awful. What do you think blah, blah, blah might want to say to awful ogre in this moment? What is awful ogre worried about or afraid of? Then we can kind of peel back the layers to get to the core of what's going on. And it makes it a little more playful. And I'll tell you, I've been working with anxiety for my entire career, one could say my entire life, and anxiety does not like playfulness. It does not like humor. And so we want to really be playful and use humor to counter that.
Another thing that I have been finding very helpful, which is, and it was in Oprah's new book, Build the Life You Want or Build the Life You Love, one of those. And she said, feel the feel and then take the wheel.
Oh, I
Feel the
love
feel.
that.
Yeah, feel the feel and then take the wheel. So if you're a catastrophizer or, you know, your inner ogre is taking over, we take the wheel and say, aha. Now I'm going to take the wheel and say, okay, that's my ogre voice.
Yeah.
And do the next things we talked about. Okay, let's ask one more question. Let's see. Can RSD be triggered for kids who have a hard time losing? Like they feel their self-worth questioned when they don't win. They feel embarrassed, or is that more perfectionism?
Probably a little bit of both, because you're not actually rejected when you lose, but if your sense of self is connected to success, then there it and you don't meet success, then you're a failure, quote unquote. And I'm actually really I want to start a trend where we replace failure with the word incomplete, because you're not a failure. You just didn't complete this task, or you're not a failure. You're still working on something. You're not a failure. It's an incompletion.
Work in progress.
Work in progress. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Sharon, as always, when you come and visit us, I am so grateful. And I think there's another part of self here, which is expert and mentor. You are the creme de la creme.
Thank you.
And
Thank you. That's so
always,
nice. I'll
yeah,
come back anytime to talk about this stuff. I feel like, maybe the next part of friendship, week of friendship, is this underbelly, that kind of gets in the way.
yes, the underbelly, truly enlightening, someone said. All right,
Thank
well,
you.
Sharon, when you get back from Australia, let's talk about our next visit. Safe
Well,
travels. Thank you
thank
for
you.
coming.
Thank you, everyone, for participating and for sharing so much. It's an honor to be here with you. Really, thank you.
Thank you. Parents, thanks for bringing the great questions. And leaving this session, go ahead and run the experiment. You have a great tool, naming the inner ogre, naming the inner ally, doing those grounding breathing exercises first. You can ask kids to draw pictures or do some sort of art project around the inner ogre. Ooh, Casey, I feel an art therapy session coming on. Okay. Casey's blowing her mind. All right, Sharon.
Thank
Love you, dear
you.
friend. Take
I'll
care.
be in touch. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone.